Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Fertility Answers podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Neil Chappell. This is Fertility Answers podcast that we host to try and give folks actionable and good information on how to navigate the fertility journey, both from a patient perspective and from different providers. So today I'm thrilled to bring on Samantha Rauber to give us some good, useful information on how to deal with a really common question that I get is, how do I deal with all the stress that comes with this fertility diagnosis, this fertility treatment plan, this fertility journey? It is pretty well documented that the diagnosis of fertility carries with it about as much stress as any other diagnosis. The only diagnosis that comes close to comparison in the regards to stress is cancer. And it's not more stressful, it is as stressful. So fertility and cancer are both about as stressful diagnoses as you can have. And that's an important thing to be aware of and to concern yourself with, because stress, as we know, is not an ideal thing, and we need to address it. And so I thought bringing an expert in the field to the forefront to have a conversation like Samantha would be a very timely and useful thing. So I appreciate your time, Samantha, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Chappell. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Samantha Rauber, and I am a licensed professional counselor, and I specialize in all things perinatal mental health, which is basically a fancy term for conception through postpartum. And these days, postpartum, clinically speaking, is up to a year after the birth of a child. So from preconception all the way up to a year postpartum. And so it's a pleasure to be talking on this subject, as I have plenty of clients who suffer great distress from the challenges with the infertility diagnosis. And I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I see it many days in clinic, just folks, you know, I have time to talk with them about their pathology and the physiology and the treatment plan and what's going on and why, but also just, it's a very real thing to sit with someone in that space and say, this is hard, mm-hmm. It's not easy to hear, mm-hmm. And this is a lot to take in. Mm-hmm. So having some space to talk about this beyond just the clinic, where sometimes patients just want to be in and be out and have other things to deal with in their lives, also probably a large source of stress, is great. So I'm looking forward to our conversation. Tell me a little bit in your mind about the incidence of stress with fertility. Is this something that you seem to see play a major role, or how do you see it?
So I usually approach infertility diagnosis as a big deal. This is what we call in psychology a complex trauma. When we're going through a family crisis, which it is a family crisis, the inability to have children is an unexpected family crisis. It's kind of like a sudden death or grief of the life that we thought we were going to be living in our parenthood journey. And so I think it's really important when we sit with patients or clients who have received the infertility diagnosis to say it out loud and to acknowledge that this is a big deal in your life. Developmentally, you know, you are enduring incredible amounts of distress. Your stress hormones are releasing significantly. You're trying to keep up with the schedule and the shots and the appointments and the time frames. There is no other option but to become obsessive with the crisis that is only negatively reinforcing. So, you know, when we can approach it from a trauma-informed lens, we can recognize the patient as a person who's wired with their own significant history of who they are, the family they come from, and the family they were hoping to have. And so when we're working with clients who are faced with infertility, regardless of physiologically if there has been a reason for it, or maybe it's a case where there's a reason that hasn't been proven yet, it's almost harder for clients who don't know what's causing it, because they're looking for the answers that people like you, Dr. Chappell, work so hard to provide for these patients who are in such crisis to begin their family planning. And so I think as long as we're as providers recognizing how stressful it is and just sitting with those patients and saying out loud, I'm recognizing that this is hard, it really can bridge the gap between this is hard for the patient and the medical staff, where it's easy to get desensitized to how hard it is because you see it all the time. And so when we can kind of acknowledge that hardness, that can go a long way. And that's the same for partners. That's the same for parents of adult children who are facing it. That's the same for friends. As long as there's some kind of acknowledgement that this is what they're going through, that can make a huge difference in supporting those patients.
Yep, that's perfect. I think you touched on a lot of key elements that I see. I mean, I think people really look for control. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, it's hard not to become obsessive. It's a normal reaction to become obsessive. So people do really not. I mean, obsessive has a negative connotation, but it's not. They really take control of every aspect they can, of documenting their cycles and managing every calorie of their diet and monitoring their intake and output and their temperature and their OPKs and their calendar and their events and when they're having intercourse and the cervical mucus. It's so much information. And it adds to the stress, but it's also a way of kind of controlling that environment. On the one hand, it's good to have a good, accurate understanding of who you are and where you are in the journey. But on the other hand, there's too much data, you get that analysis by paralysis mentality. So that's a difficult balance to strike. And like you kind of annotated, it's probably the right balance is probably different for each patient and how they are and how their personality is and what their diagnosis is. I agree that unexplained infertility is a very stressful, frustrating diagnosis. And often that's how I introduce and someone has unexplained infertility. I'm going to say, you're going to be really frustrated with this, but you have unexplained infertility.
Yes.
They're like, yep, I'm frustrated. That's a fact.
Yes, exactly.
And I think another important point that you hit on is that these are unplanned events that counterbalance folks' expectation of fall in love, get married, have kids. They're like, wait a minute, why isn't this going as I expected? Why isn't this going as I planned? And so having to kind of reroute expectations of the journey of how you're going to get to where you want to be with your life goals of, you know, get married, have babies, have white picket fence, or whatever order you decide. That's an important thing to acknowledge as well.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I was going to ask you, one of the most common questions that I get probably 87 times a day is how does stress impact fertility? And so I'm sure your patients are coming to you saying, this is really stressing me out. I don't want to have an adverse effect on my fertility with the stress. How do I get rid of the stress so that I can get pregnant? Because everybody gets told, all you need to do is just not be stressed and you'll get pregnant. What do you tell patients about stress and its impact and its role in fertility and conception?
So in that way, how I kind of frame my sessions with clients who are going through it, I am supportive of them coming to therapy as an effective tool to release that stress. So like you had mentioned, having to control your cycle and paying so much attention to all of the scheduling, the shots, the cycles, intercourse, there's a total loss of spontaneity usually in the relationship. Every aspect of their lives are affected by infertility and having to control some aspect of a life that they probably used to enjoy. So while we're kind of making a space for the grief and the trauma that comes with infertility and the loss of the life that they thought they were going to have, we're also inviting those clients to go ahead and lean into the distress and release it by coming to therapy, because it acts as a pressure release valve, being able to say the feelings out loud, not avoiding the feelings, because once the feelings are avoided, that creates a whole different realm of problems. And so as long as they're acknowledging for themselves how loud it is, and it's being met by somebody who understands, and there's no shame about it, and just the ownership of how hard it is, it works as a pressure release valve. So starting therapy is obviously a way to release the stress, but then also learning physiologically how things that are being required of you going to infertility specialists and working with the physicians, you need a break from that realm as well. So what can we bring back from your life that made you feel alive and like a person? And what pleasurable events can we put in the mix while we're making space for the stress release, which is coming to the therapy and doing the yoga and getting the physical exercise and all of the by the book situations and experiences that we know help those endorphins be released alongside those cortisol releasing stress inducing situations? How do we still find joy in a time that's very dire and serious and controlled? So do you like to paint? Do you like to listen to music? Do you like to journal? I want my clients to know that they're still allowed to live a life while they're having to obsess in a way that they absolutely have to by going through treatment. Does that make sense?
Yeah. My old mentor used to say, go do something fun.
Yes.
That's what he would say after either a difficult conversation or even an IUI or an embryo transfer, when he knew that the patient had just so much riding on that outcome of that answer or that conversation or that decision. He'd say, just go do something fun. Don't think about me for 72 hours.
Which is impossible to do.
But yeah, so that they'd always look at him like he was crazy. But at the same time, you know, the intent, like you're saying, was there. So find something that you know to go do. And I think you also hit on a really important point too that I find to be really powerful. And when I'm talking to folks, is this becomes more of a procreation thing than a recreation thing.
Yes.
And so, you know, you're timing all your intercourse. And so now being a couple is no longer fun.
Yes.
One of the things I tell folks is, hey, listen, we're going to tell you, this is how your fertile window is. We need to cover this base at this time, but forever and a day other than that, just be a couple. Don't think about it every day, every other day. That's not as important as people really make it out in the blogs and the TikToks or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to cover your bases in this fertile window and then step back and just live your life and give yourself permission to be tired one day or not the other or whatever. And, you know, try and, you know, get back to things that don't matter. Separate procreation from recreation and just have fun in the other aspects of your life.
Which is a little bit easier to do as long as there is a supportive person in these patients' life acknowledging mm-hmm. how hard it is,
yeah.
you know, because patients would look at your old mentor when he says, go do something fun, like he has a third eye or something, because, you know, they're clearly in distress. So
yeah.
I love to encourage like support systems with women who are going through these challenges to just kind of like be there or show up or lean in or ask if she wants to talk about it, because mm-hmm. that in and of itself is acknowledging how hard it is. And it's a whole lot easier to jump into doing something fun once that person has been heard and understood.
Let me ask about that balance then, because here's the things that I've heard. I agree that it's important to have a good support system, and that's either your family or some of your close friends or obviously your partner. And it's great if you have a support system out there in the world that may not necessarily be family or friends, but also other folks who are going through fertility.
Correct.
Here's the feedback that I've gotten. So I want to ask you about both extremes. So sometimes patients say, I don't really want to be in a support group because I don't want to hear other people constantly complaining.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd like to talk a little bit about how to find the right support group for you.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing, or support group or support system, doesn't necessarily need to be anything formal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the other extreme is, what about folks that encounter experiences of people that just completely don't get it,
mm-hmm.
right? So, mm-hmm. you know, they're, you know, how do you deal with the baby shower or mm-hmm. the person that keeps asking you when you're going to have kids or mm-hmm. things like that? So on the one hand, people... Some folks don't like submersing themselves in just people that are dealing with fertility. But on the other extreme, some people have difficulty submersing themselves in people that are completely clueless about fertility.
So
how do you deal with both those extremes?
So those extremes are very much together in the experience of facing infertility. You're going to come across people who dismiss it, who don't get it, who say things that come with the best of intentions, but really add to the trauma of what the people are going through, as well as I can't sit in another space with other people because I'm barely able to, you know, do it myself. So in group therapy, not necessarily support group, because it's not necessarily run by a professional who knows how to facilitate all of those extremes. In a therapy group where the women can come together and feel what they have to feel without taking care of each other, is a very beautiful thing. And a therapy group is very different than a support group, because a support group would, of course, be a lot of venting and releasing of all of the emotions that everybody else understands. But a therapy group is different because it has an intervention woven into it. So not only are the women coming together to do all of the feelings of it all, but we're also utilizing each one of us who sits in there, who does get it and who knows what that person could have said to make that other person feel better. So they're actually interacting in corrective conversations. They're learning tools to cope with the stress. A lot of cognitive therapy comes up. We can kind of identify what are the thoughts that are trauma induced versus what are the thoughts that are just normal human thoughts. And so we're weaving in an intervention to where the women who come to the therapy group not only come and feel what they have to feel, but also get to release it in a way where there are no strings attached, because none of the women get to be friends, which is unfortunate, but also very fortunate for the women, because then they don't have to feel like they have to carry the other person's story. And it really makes a pathway for these women to actually care wholeheartedly about one another because they're strangers. So a therapy group is different from a support group because it has boundaries in place to honor the work that's being done without those strings being attached. And there's a huge difference in that way because of that intervention.
Okay. I don't think I ever really appreciated that distinction. I think that's really helpful. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit more about some good actionable coping mechanisms that you find to be helpful in patients that they come to you with issues and concerns about fertility and stress and anxiety, et cetera.
So one of my favorite coping skills to teach the women I work with is how to mother themselves, you know, and their great desire of wanting to become a mother. Fertility complications, unfortunately, but fortunately, allow a pause to really get to know themselves as a person, what their emotional needs are, what emotional needs are not being met, which becomes very clear when they're under the stress and distress of going through fertility treatments. And it's a really, really opportune time to start to discover what are emotions, what do these mean, can I feel them? Most of us are afraid of feeling them. So when we have to cope, that means we also have to feel. So one of the ways that I teach women how to feel is by mothering themselves. So husband might not have any idea how to comfort his wife in distress, which is very normal and natural, but causes a lot of anger and distress, you know, from the woman's perspective, because those emotional needs are not being met. So I come in and I explain, he's not going to get it, you know. Like, you have the uterus, you have the brain that's, you know, transforming in this process. What do you need to hear from a loving person in this moment of the distress that you're having? And normally what they come up with and what it comes down to is just hearing what they have to say. And of coursing themselves, of course, I'm having a hard time with this. My third round of IUI just failed, or I'm about to enter into my fifth IVF transfer and I'm feeling a little less hopeful. You know, just the ability to say out loud what they feel, but then also come up with the response that gives themselves permission to actually feel what they're feeling. Because the trick about emotions is that we won't move through them until we actually feel them. And so many of us, and how it adds to the trauma, are wired to avoid our emotions. And so when I'm working with women who are in these situations where time has kind of paused, it creates a space to build coping skills in a toolbox, such as mothering themselves in a way that they're kind of learning to transform their inner dialogue, because a lot of women going through the trauma of this start to really embrace things being their fault that they feel guilty for, and it's their brain's way of trying to make sense out of it. And so I'm really quick to point out, wait a minute, the way that you're talking to yourself on the inside is adding to the problem. So let's take out that mothering self-coping skill. What would a loving person in your life say in response to the difficulty you're having? And then what I usually do is kind of say, if someone in the group was talking about this, how would you support that person? And usually it's far different from what they're telling themselves on the inside. And that's just how psychology works. So equipping them with cognitive tools, such as the ability to mother themselves, it takes some practice. But I think it really highlights, wait a minute, the language that my brain is feeding me on the inside is actually adding to the stress cycle rather than relieving it.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why the first thing I recommend in folks that ask about stress and fertility, or even maybe that don't ask, but I'm kind of getting that signal that they would benefit, is to say, hey, you probably need to go talk to counselor, therapist, and give them our list. The other things that I'll tell them is find something that helps you, as like you said, a pressure valve release, something that mediates the stress that you enjoy that also can help benefit fertility. Because there's a bunch of things that kind of overlap with reducing stress and help fertility. And that's, I kind of point them towards an exercise that they enjoy. Some people like the gym, some people don't. So like, you know, tennis, volleyball, yoga.
Definitely.
Like whatever is active that gets you out in the sunshine is going to help with stress, but also help with fertility.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, meditation, yoga, acupuncture, those things have a nice little overlap too. So I kind of point them in those directions, in addition to getting the help with the cognitive therapy and things like that.
Well, no doubt. Anything that gets their body moving makes them kind of like lean into the body, when during the time of infertility treatments, your body definitely becomes a science experiment. So a lot of the times women get a little detached from their body. And so doing things like yoga or going to the gym or getting some exercise really helps them psychologically kind of embrace the body that they have somehow faulted in the trauma experience of what they're going through, that, like you said, overlaps with improved chances of being able to conceive in the first place.
Well, I'd never thought of it from that perspective. That's kind of cool. I think you're right. Well, I'm taking up a lot of your time, but there's one more thing that I want to touch on before we conclude. And that is, you mentioned the partners don't get it. You're right. They don't. And that's okay. Some do, but it's rare.
Yes.
What advice do you have for the partners and how to support their partner that's going through the more rigorous fertility treatments? Because I mean, you know, I have husbands that have difficulty supporting their wives. I have wives that have difficulty supporting their wives. Because it's a complicated dynamic when one patient or one partner of the couple is bearing the brunt of the treatments.
Yes.
So what advice do you have for how partners can help?
I'm going to make this very easy, okay? For the partners and the wives and the husbands and whoever doesn't get it, acknowledge that you don't get it. Just say that out loud. And, you know, if the woman who's going through the treatments is experiencing distress, do not avoid it. So, you know, oftentimes when things are stressful, we avoid because the pain is too great. What a woman needs who's going through it is somebody who's going to sit with her in the distress, and they don't even have to say anything. They just can let her talk. They can hold her hands. They can check in on her. What's on your mind? Lean into it rather than avoid it. And that's all that's really necessary.
I'll add one other thing that a husband said to me last week that was really something. They came back for a second cycle of treatment. They were ready for baby number two. So they came back and he said something really interesting. He said, you know what I've learned from the first round that I'm not going to do this round is I didn't tell her all the things I was feeling because I thought I needed to be the strong one.
Exactly.
And she took that as I wasn't feeling anything.
Absolutely.
And so sometimes they say, I don't get it. And they need to say, I don't get it. But I think sometimes they needed to say, actually, I do get it. I just process it a different way, but you should know that I totally get it.
Yes.
And I'm doing my best to try and be here for you in the ways that you need, but I'm going to process this and display this a little bit different than you.
Yes.
But he said that when he told her, actually, that really sucked for me too. That was a complete revelation for her. She thought that he was going through it easy peasy.
Totally.
And it was really a difficult time for him. And then when he actually told her, she was like, really? I didn't know. And he's like, how did you not know? Of course it was hard for me.
Yes.
And so it was just, so yes, say, I don't get it. But if you get it, say you get it.
Yeah.
And that was kind of an interesting thing.
And say that you get it, but you don't get it in the way that, you know, their bodies are processing it very differently. Because so often I'm trying to teach husbands and partners, you know, you have to lean into the discomfort just as much, because there's healing that happens when both people in the relationship are able to say how hard it is together. And it doesn't condone how hard it is. It actually helps the person who's suffering and the partner feel connected and more emotionally intimate, which is part of the loss of the trauma of it all, because we do process it differently. So yes, lean in, express your feelings, which I know is so hard to do, especially for men who have been raised to learn that their feelings don't matter, but their feelings really mm-hmm. do, and that can make mm-hmm. a huge difference.
Yeah, I just have to look up in the dictionary the definition of feelings, and then maybe I'd be able to.
That's exactly right. that's exactly right.
Okay, well, Samantha, I've really enjoyed and appreciated your time today and going through all of these really, really great little nuggets and pieces of advice. Any particular resources that you have to point our patients to, or any final kind of wrap up thoughts for patients out there that you think they need
yes.
to hear?
Yes. So in the quest for finding a therapist, my encouraging advice is to find a therapist who specializes in perinatal, because well-intentioned, good therapists, unfortunately, do sometimes make mistakes without being able to recognize infertility as trauma. So I just opened a new clinic called Baton Rouge Perinatal Counseling. There's six of us perinatal clinicians that are equipped to work through infertility with clients. We also pull clients to do group therapy. Baton Rouge Perinatal Counseling, it has a website, just batonrougeperinatalcounseling.com. They can send us messages that way. I can also get in touch with them once they send us a message and give them the names of providers that are open for new clients and have availability. So finding a therapist, but finding a specialist is really important.
Cool. Well, again, I appreciate your time. I know you've got patients to see, as do I. So we will go back to practicing medicine once again after this really fun and I hope to be a helpful conversation for some folks out there. If anybody has any thoughts or questions, as always, you can email us at podcast@fertilityanswers.com. But until next month, again, I'm Dr. Neil Chappell, and appreciate everybody's time, especially yours today, Samantha.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Bye.
Bye.